There is this powerful, powerful tool that is actual ownership, that ownership of a portion or all of the business combined with this ownership culture development. We all know that the business can only succeed if the employees are aligned and engaged. And this is a powerful tool that can help you engage your workforce, can actually help you grow your business faster, get to those goals faster, whatever they may be.
Shareholder primacy and share value maximization are not the focus for purpose-driven founders. Instead, purpose-driven founders see profits as a tool to support a company's mission. Profits are reinvested in business and shared with all stakeholders. Profits are not an objective in themselves, but a means by which the purpose is furthered. The question is, can your commitment to the triple bottom line continue if leadership and ownership change? Over the last 6 weeks, starting with episode 137, we explored this question from various perspectives. We invited guests who dedicate their work to alternative ownership. They have shared about the different ownership structures to protect your purpose, the relationship between governance, ownership, and financing, the transition process to alternative ownership, and if alternative ownership is right for you and your business. Today's episode is the seventh and last episode of this alternative ownership podcast series. We hope you have learned a ton about the alternative ownership model, from the cooperative model to the perpetual purpose trust model. For the last episode of this podcast series, we close the series with Allison Lingain, co-founder of Project Equity. Allison shares, among other, her personal hypothesis on why employee ownership wasn't taught in business school, the different ways to get into employee ownership, the financing structure and financial institution that support the transition to employee ownership, and the role of financial record keeping and financial forecasting in planning for transition to employee ownership. You're listening to her CEO Journey, the business finance podcast for mission-driven women entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Christina Shahli. If you are new here, a big warm welcome. If we are not connected on LinkedIn, please reach out and say hi, because that's where I hang out and share my business finance tips. If you have been listening to this podcast for a while and you are a regular listener, I want you to know I appreciate you. My podcast won't be around without your support. This is a free weekly show where my guests and I want to inspire you to balance between mission and profit, to create an impact in this world, and to achieve financial equality through your business for good. As you are listening to this episode and the other six episodes in this Alternative Ownership podcast series, our guests often share the common characteristic of purpose-driven businesses that are successful to transition to employee ownership or other alternative ownership model. A successful transition to alternative ownership model requires a credible business model and strategic plan, a track record of business profitability, sound financial management oversight, as well as the capacity to adopt effective governance systems. A sound financial management oversight includes your ability to create well-thought financial forecasting for the long term. Financial forecasting is a combination of your historical record as well as your vision for the future. If you don't have a financial forecast in place and would like to know how to build a well-thought financial forecast, then we have created a guide for you. Use the link in the show notes to download the guide and jumpstart your financial forecasting journey. When you are ready to focus on building your business and want us to manage the financial back office process that comes with a virtual CFO, connect with us at christinashahli.com/let's chat. Allison Lingain, welcome to her CEO journey. It is a pleasure to have you here today.
It's so wonderful to be here with you today. Thanks for making the time for this conversation.
So before we dive into employee ownership and appropriate deal structure to finance a transition to employee ownership, I would like you to share with my audience, how did you start your journey to founding Project Equity?
As many folks on your podcast are probably have similar experiences, you know, it makes sense in the rearview mirror and is a little windy on the path to where we got. So, you know, way back when, first job out of college, you know, this was now 30 years ago, was running job training programs for young people. I worked at really a neighborhood-based community youth organization, and I worked primarily with the high school students. And job training is a space and a field that's really, really important in terms of creating paths to opportunity for people. And I think the space has come a long way in the last 30 years. When I first got into it, the young people who we worked with, this nonprofit had a contract with local parks. So every day, 5 days after school and Saturday mornings, we would, you know, get the van and the tools and go to a local park and do weeding and mulching and that kind of work. You know, I started just thinking and learning more about what the job training space is all about and started asking the question, well, you know, why are there so many job training programs that really are training even for adults in what are frankly poverty level jobs or jobs that don't have a lot of opportunity? So getting a job is great, but then where do you go from there? How do we really think about what the infrastructure is needed to break the cycles of poverty? So while I was there, at this nonprofit organization, I built a program where the young people could create their own micro enterprises. So they could get promoted from the entry-level job training into this micro enterprise development program. Probably not surprising, the difference between asking people to show up and kind of check their brains at the door and rake and mulch and sweep versus really, you can't check your brain at the door because you are creating something. You're a part of all of the pieces of what this new enterprise is going to be. It was day and night difference. The same young person and the two different programs, day and night difference, right? So if you ask people to bring their full selves, they absolutely do. And, you know, seeing some of these young people, it was just amazing. That to me is kind of what has really framed up the rest of the story. So I left there to get my MBA. I went to the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business. I wanted a set of skills to be able to scale programs that were really creating opportunity for people and, you know, really leveraging the business world. And so I left my MBA program wanting to get real world business experience. So I, you know, went into the mission, worked in mission-driven companies, sort of in, you know, different executive roles over a period of nearly a couple of decades, and always in this quest for how do we create opportunity for people and how do we do it at scale. I've been on this learning journey, how does it all work, and really itching to get more back to sort of the roots of where I started, and just started meeting people and was introduced to my co-founder, Hillary Abell. And that was the first time that I had learned about this business model called employee ownership. Mind you, I'd been to business school. I'd been in mission-driven companies. And that was my light bulb moment of, oh my gosh, wow, this really is a business model where that opportunity is baked in. So I become an employee at an employee-owned company, and I have the opportunity for a job that really is, you know, high quality job, has the ability to not only have higher wages and good benefits, but also to have asset building for me and my family, which really is what breaks the cycle of poverty, what breaks that chain of intergenerational poverty, and also has professional development opportunities because these are workplaces where, back to that experience in the two job training programs, these are companies where people are asked to bring their full selves. They're asked to bring their ideas and their energy and their creativity and their you know, their sense of ownership and what that looks like to the job. And then in some workplaces that are employee owned, there is also the opportunity to run for and be elected to serve on the board of directors of the business, which is a tremendous professional development opportunity and can open up all sorts of new avenues. And so the question then became, where have you been all my life, basically? Like, you know, why haven't I heard about this? Why is it that this isn't being taught at the top business schools? Because all of the data shows that employee-owned companies outperform their peers. They're better for workers. They're better for the businesses. And so therefore, they're better for the communities in which they operate. So why isn't this being taught? And so what can we do about it became the next question. And that really is the genesis of Project Equity. And what we're trying to do about it is we're trying to make this into something that is normal and self-generating, and people have heard about it. And in fact, it's the preferred business model, because again, all of the data backs up that this is a business model that truly is a win-win-win for the business, for the workers, for communities, and for the founders as well.
Okay, you kind of intrigued me there, because the question that you're asking, why this has not been taught in majority of business school, right? Because I never heard about employee ownership until a few months ago. I understand about stock option. I worked for a startup before. I know I have a stock option, but this is a completely different model. So why do you think this has not been taught in the business school?
I don't know that I have a great answer to that, but I can give you some hypotheses. I think that in the US in particular, the founder is the hero. Probably over the past three decades or something, this shift from like, I'm founding my business to start a business and maybe I'll support my family with that business or whatever it may be, a self-sustaining enterprise that it gets to a certain size and it might stay there happily. And that's good for everyone. It's good for our communities versus, oh, it's all about the capital and the big opportunity. And really the entrepreneur and the capital providers are the kind of the heroes of the story, if you will. And just a little side stat, which, you know, referring to our baby boomer business owners, they're a real entrepreneurial generation. And today, that generation owns an estimated one out of every two of our local privately owned businesses that employ people. So that the local job creators are, half of them are owned by baby boomers. And those businesses need new owners, right? Because baby boomers are retiring already and are going to continue to retire. Yeah, that's really what's being taught in business school. You know, just a quick side story. When I was at Haas, the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business, this was in the late 1990s. The internet was just getting started and everyone was going to start their internet company, you know. And there was a business plan competition, the Berkeley Business Plan Competition. I believe it still exists today. And everyone was designing their big internet empire. And of course, you know, the dot-com bust happened shortly thereafter. But, you know, while I was there, there were a group of us who said, well, gosh, there's got to be a way to start businesses that are really about creating positive change in the world and creating revenues, right? Because you got to pay for that business and make it self-sustaining, but where the leading reason for you doing the business is to create positive change in the world. So we founded what's now the Global Social Venture Competition back in, I believe it was 1999, still going strong today, but it was the first business plan competition of its kind that required a social return on investment. So the financials that you had to submit included your normal profit and loss statement, but also a social return on investment analysis that forced you really to think about what is the change I'm going to create in the world through this business. So, you know, the way that I think about this is it's business exists, yes, because we need to make money and support ourselves and our families. We need to do good by our employees and our customers and our vendors. And, you know, gosh, if we could also create some positive change in the world on top of that, that's what success looks like. And frankly, I think that's how success should be defined in business.
I completely agree. And then you brought back some memory from 1995, 1994, when I was in a business school, right? I went to University of Oregon and I was in an accounting program over there. And I clearly remember one of my projects for the whole semester was about calculating shareholder value. That was the whole project. How can we increase more value for the shareholders? There was no talk about other stakeholders. I had no clue about this social enterprise model, thinking about the different stakeholders, not only the shareholders, until, to tell you the truth, like 3 years ago. And then that's only because my own experience is just something is nagging me. Something is not right. And then I don't know what is not right, right? And then it's always that. You don't have the answer. You kind of feel like there is misalignment. And how can you feel to be in alignment again? But I wish, and then I know there are more and more business school that talk about social entrepreneurship, that is talk about like the ability of a business should go beyond the shareholder value. If we have been thinking about this all along for generation and generation, thinking about beyond the shareholder's value, I don't think we would be in this situation in the world right now with the climate change, right? But unfortunately, that wasn't the case.
The thing about it is that employee ownership, you know, there's sort of this narrative of, oh, well, there's trade-offs, right? If you do good in the world, maybe you're going to decrease your shareholder value. But employee ownership really puts that on its head, because employee ownership is doing good in the world, and it's actually increasing your enterprise value and your shareholder value at the same time. So we just need to understand that if you engage your stakeholders and do well by your stakeholders, your business will be more successful. So you're not giving something up, you're actually adding.
Let's get into the employee ownership. What are the different ways to get into employee ownership?
Yeah, so at Project Equity, which, you know, we're a national nonprofit organization, and we support businesses in all of the forms of what we call broad-based employee ownership. And there are many forms, but just very briefly, the three most common that your listeners might be familiar with: the ESOP form. ESOP is an acronym that stands for Employee Stock Ownership Plan. This form of ownership is basically created by Congress. They passed legislation in the late 70s, strengthened in the 80s, in order to encourage employee ownership because of all the reasons we're talking about today, that employee ownership is good, and gave a lot of tax breaks to businesses that utilize this particular form. So it was a way for the federal government to say, we want business owners to integrate employee ownership. And so we're going to give you a bunch of tax benefits, and you have to kind of follow the rules and the regulations associated in order to get those tax benefits. Shares are owned in a trust on behalf of the employees, and it's structured as a retirement plan. So it follows many of the guidelines that a 401k would follow. And so those are great for businesses that are above a certain size. So a rule of thumb is sort of 40 employees or higher might be a good fit because of the regulations associated with those tax benefits. There's costs, which means if you're much smaller than that, it doesn't really pencil out. There's also a worker cooperative form of broad-based employee ownership, which is a form of cooperative. So many people may have heard of, you know, food co-ops or farmer co-ops. Ocean Spray is a farmer co-op, for example. Many brands or rural electric co-ops serve a lot of people in the United States. So it's a form of cooperative, which is a business that is owned and governed by and for the benefit of its members. So in a food co-op, a consumer co-op, you know, it's the people who shop there who are the members. So it's owned by the consumers. And in a worker co-op, it's owned and governed by and for the benefit of the workers, the employees. I was talking about the professional development opportunity to be able to serve on the board of directors. So a cooperative form of employee ownership has built into it a board of directors made up by majority employee owners. So if you have a board of seven, you know, maybe four of them are employee owners and three are external, and they're elected by the full base of employee owners. And then the third is a trust structure that utilizes the perpetual trust. It can be an employee ownership trust, a perpetual purpose trust. There's different flavors of it, but the idea is the shares of the company are held sort of in perpetuity and based upon the rules of what that definition means at the state level, on behalf of, insert the, is it the employees? Is it the purpose? So that company is essentially preserved, can't be sold. So this is a great way for founders who have a business that they really, really, really want to make sure, whether it's because it has an important mission or they see it as an important job creating engine in their community, or it has an important innovation role in an industry. And they really want to make sure the company isn't, you know, bought up by private equity and then becomes traded around in those spaces, but that it is preserved and that it's preserved to serve its purpose, whether that is, you know, the employees or a broader purpose that is inclusive of the employees.
Are there like pro and cons for each? If a founder is thinking about employee ownership and then they listen to this episode and they're thinking, is it ESOP? Is it worker cooperative? Is it trust structure?
The thought process shouldn't start with what's the right form. The thought process always starts with, well, what's the goal? Goals, usually plural. And why am I interested in a broader set of ownership? Can be just employees or it can include other stakeholders as well. What am I trying to accomplish with that? And then from there, you figure out, okay, so my goal is, let's just pick a goal or two. My goal is increased employee engagement, plus setting up for me an exit option that's 5 or 8 or 10 years down the line. So ownership and high, you know, participatory engagement and involvement in the business, that sort of recipe gives you very strong employee engagement. So let's create a plan then for you that starts with some level of ownership now, really focuses then on building the culture of ownership, that participation, that engagement. Maybe at this point, you do bring a seat on the board that is for an employee, and there's a process for that that becomes a professional development opportunity, becomes, again, a deeper engagement opportunity. And that then sets you up. You've kind of built the employee ownership container, if you will, and you've started activating it and getting some of the benefits of it. And then as you're thinking about your own exit timeline that's in the future, then you can do a full transition to employee ownership. You know, maybe at this point you're doing 30% or even some value less than that. I pick 30 because depending on the form, that's a threshold where some tax benefits kick in. And then 5 years down the line, you're ready to do your exit operationally from the business. And so between now and then, you're really grooming the next general manager or whatever your CEO title is and your management team and making sure that all of the roles that you play are covered. And then you exit in that time frame and do the remaining to get to 100% transaction. Maybe you're big enough to be an ESOP. And so the tax benefits are worth it. And so you're doing an ESOP and then you're pulling in some components of a worker co-op because you really want that employee voice on the board. Or maybe for you, it's really about, I don't want this business, I want it to live on in quote, air quotes, perpetuity. So I'm going to do the perpetual trust structure. And I do also want employee engagement. So I'm going to do the perpetual trust structure with some components of what a worker co-op brings. So you always want to start with the goals and then you map the goals. It's not always about just one of the structures, as you noted from my comments. It's sometimes you can pull from more than one in order to accomplish those goals. That's the starting point, right? And then you can map out what that process and that timeline looks like. You can do it in multiple stages in order to accomplish those goals.
When you said pulling multiple line, are you saying that maybe a business can start, if they are big enough, maybe they can start with the ESOP model. And then after that, eventually they move to a cooperative and then eventually move to a trust.
Yeah. So it's not so much as moving from one to another. It's you can have an ESOP and a worker co-op coexist with each other.
Oh.
You can use, if you're big enough for an ESOP, you can set up an ESOP and get the tax benefits of the ESOP and then build in the voting and the participation of a worker co-op. You don't think about it as like, I'm going to transition from form A to form B to form C. You think about it of what are my goals and what are the characteristics of the different forms that meet my goals? And can I pull on those different characteristics? You can't always combine them, right? An ESOP doesn't have the perpetuity of the perpetual trust or the employee ownership trust. So that's a choice, right? Do I want one or the other? That perpetual trust doesn't have the tax benefits of the ESOP. So there are trade-offs, but it doesn't mean that it's one versus the other. You can kind of combine some of the elements together.
I know one of the things that came up often when I mentioned about employee ownership, nobody really understands the difference between ESOP and worker cooperative. Can you give a high level understanding for my audience, what are the differences between ESOP and worker cooperative?
I'll start with a worker co-op. So as I mentioned, it's a business that exists, is owned by and for the benefits of its workers, owned and governed. So one of the key characteristics of a worker co-op is that it has governance by the employees built into it. So the board of directors is made up of a majority of employee owners who are elected by the full base. So if you had 100 employees, let's say they're all employee owners, that you might have a board of seven, and four of them would be elected by the full base of those 100. So the representative democracy, if you will. So there's other components, but that's probably the most meaningful differentiation, if you will, of a worker co-op. And then an ESOP is, as I mentioned, was, you know, sort of created by, the structure was created by Congress. And so it really is a retirement plan. It's a retirement plan that owns the shares of a company's stock. It can own 100% of the shares, or it can own a very small percentage of the shares and anything in between. And so the shares of the company exist in this trust that help the employees build the asset of ownership that they can then access once they retire or leave the company. So either of those scenarios, but it's designed as a retirement plan. And so as the value of the business grows over time, and of course we know that doesn't happen 100% of the time, but when I retire, I get the value of that paid out to me over a period of years. I have this amazing retirement savings that has grown because of this, the direct connection between my work and my engagement in that business and the success of that business over time. So an ESOP does not have built into it things like profit sharing, which can be really important, you know, if you want to think of it as a tool for employee engagement or a benefit to employees that, you know, means you're doing well by your employees. Profit sharing can be really important. There's nothing in an ESOP that says you can't do profit sharing. So you can add profit sharing in to help get some financial benefit to your employees today, help bridge, you know, the difference between kind of the cost, the current salaries, if you will, of your lower end pay scale and the ability to actually live comfortably, which often has a gap. And there's nothing that says in an ESOP, you can't have employees on the board. So you can build in these other things. That's why I was saying it's not about one versus the other necessarily. It's about starting with your goals. If I'm aiming for employee engagement today, then profit sharing is probably an important tool. Participatory culture. Maybe that's inclusive of government's role. You know, maybe not. So start with the goals, and then you can map those goals to what the different forms offer. And there's ways to kind of pick from the different forms, but not exclusively.
So I know one of the complicated areas in transitioning to employee ownership is structuring the financing. So if you can explain the financing process when you work with clients, more from what should they think about?
So let me first explain how this all works. So I own a company and I'm interested in starting off with 30% employee ownership. I'm not retiring. I'm doing it because I believe in it. I believe in stakeholder engagement. I want to do right by my employees. And I believe that my business outcomes are going to be better when I have that stakeholder engagement. So let's just say the value of my company is $10 million. I'm just going to use round numbers for easier math. The value of my company is $10 million. So the value of that 30% is $3 million. And I am going to keep this high level. So if there's any employee ownership experts listening to this, you know, you might be like, oh, but and there's an asterisk and there's this and that. I'm just going to do the most simplest approach here. Yeah. So $3 million of business value. And so what happens when that goes from being owned by me to being owned by my employees is that I am being paid $3 million for that. So where does that money come from? Yeah. My employees probably don't have $3 million in their mattresses or, you know, their rich uncle or, you know, aren't going to take out HELOCs to cover that.
They don't have money grow on trees.
Right. So this is one of the important things to understand about employee ownership. And also it drives many of the misconceptions that mean that owners reject it out of hand. for this example, I'm going to simplify it and say it's coming from the external financing source. So I need a $3 million loan. The business is the one that's taken out that $3 million loan. And so the business is taking that out based upon its historical cash flow. So kind of the first step of could this work for me is a feasibility analysis, which runs these numbers in a spreadsheet. It does what's called a debt capacity analysis to say, well, how much debt can my company take on? Can I take on a $3 million debt and pay it back over a period of, say, 5 to 7 years? And so if that debt capacity based upon, you know, my last 5 years of financials shows that I can take on a $3 million debt, then I'm going to get financing to be able to buy me out. I get a $3 million check. And then the company has a $3 million loan on the books that it pays back over time out of its profits. And so you can think of it this way, in that essentially the employees are working hard at the business, and the profit that that hard work generates is what's enabling them to become owners, because that profit is paying back that $3 million loan.
How does the employee start owning it? I'm just trying to think. So yeah, the business borrow money, and who is paying to the lender? It's not the business.
The business is the one paying to the lender. So that okay, loan sits on the books of the business. Company name now has a $3 million loan,
yep,
from a lending institution. I'm not going to use the word bank, and I'll get to that in a second. From a lending institution that is to pay back this loan to buy my 30% of the ownership.
Yeah, so to pay the owner, right?
To pay the owner, right.
Yeah, the debt, right, that $3 million, the owner is going to receive that $3 million.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so the company pays that back over time, you know, 5-year loan. It could be a typical loan amortization, regular payments, kind of like a regular mortgage, or mm-hmm, it can have some features that, you know, you see sometimes in home mortgages where you have no interest to start and then you have a bigger payment at the end or whatever. So there's different ways to structure it. But if you just assume it's a regular old 5-year loan, it's, you know, every month you're paying that principal and interest down. So then how do the employees become owners? It depends on the form. So I won't get into the details, but in some forms, you become an owner immediately as soon as you qualify. So maybe there's you have to have been an employee for a year, or you have to be working at least 30 hours a week or something like that. And in other forms, you become your shares vest over time. So you become a partial owner and then sort of a full ownership over your shares over a period, maybe it's 3 to 5 years. The details depend on the form, but your employees are not paying, they're not bringing cash to cover the cost of that. They're working hard at your business and creating profit, and that profit then buys their ownership.
Oh, okay. I see. Because I thought maybe the employees for those debts through their salary. That's what I thought.
That's what most people assume, which is where employee ownership is different. It's just a little bit different from kind of the way if you were selling to a third party, somebody else is buying the business and then they have that loan. They have it to pay it personally, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Employee ownership just works differently. And that's in some ways really the beauty of it. Because this enables you as the founder, you know, with most of your listeners as founders, you as the founder to be able to get paid that $3 million. And it enables your employees to become owners in a situation where your employees probably don't have the $3 million to be able to buy it.
So you are saying technically that's the debt, you calculated what is your profit at the end of the year. Maybe that's how it works. And then after that, you already determine a portion of that profit is to pay out the debt.
That's exactly right.
That's interesting. I know that it's not always going to be straightforward. Based on what I'm reading on your private project equity website, I know it's more complicated than that. And I, not to get into too much technical, but there is the thought process of the loan, it seems like it's being matched to the balance sheet of the business. So for example, if a company has a lot of inventory, a lot of maybe account receivable, accounts payable, there is a component of the debt, maybe more on financing the working capital, but there could be others on the balance sheets that requires a different type of debt. Do you think you can explain that a little bit?
In many cases, companies, when they're doing an employee ownership transition, they are needing both what we call transaction financing. So that's that $3 million in the example we've been talking about. So transaction financing to purchase the 30% of the business from the current owner and a working capital loan. Because maybe as part of the sale of that 30%, you know, the owner is pulling out some of their what they own in the business, you know, the so there may be a need for an infusion of cash, or maybe it's just a part of, you know, running the business that, you know, we've been running really tight on cash. And now that we're taking on this additional debt, maybe we need a line of credit versus a working capital loan. So yes, absolutely. You need to look at the whole and you need to look at what the cash needs are, because the last thing you want to do is to set the business up so that it can't pay back the loan that you've taken on. Because you don't want to put the business at risk by doing this. Instead, what you want to be doing is setting up the right amount of debt so that you can you know, take this opportunity for the owner to get some liquidity from the business, to get some cash out, you know, some payment for that 30% ownership share. And then that increased employee engagement and that investment in the ownership culture that you're going to do as a part of this, that actually increases the value of the business so that, you know, in 5 years or 8 years, when maybe you're selling the remaining 70%, it's actually of a higher value than it would have been if you hadn't sold the 30% to your employees 5 or 7 years ago.
So let me clarify. Based on what you just explained to me, the debt itself, it's sometimes when a business transitioned to employee ownership, the structure of the debt is not only to pay the owner, but it's also to give access to capital to grow the business.
So you can think of the ability to bring more capital into your business on two fronts. The first is that you can combine a transaction with, you know, a working capital loan. The second is about creating more profit, which creates more forward investment capital. The National Center for Employee Ownership did a study that showed employee-owned businesses grew 2% more year over year, not one time, but compounding year after year than their non-employee-owned peers. And that growth by itself can also bring increased capital, right? Because you're more profitable. You're creating your own capital through your increased profit in order to invest in the business.
You also mentioned earlier about not a bank, but a lending institution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that?
So in the same way that, you know, neither you nor I heard about this in business school, and for the very reason that Project Equity exists to try and make this normal and self-generating, today it isn't. There is lower awareness than we would all like for there to be. And that lower awareness extends to financial institutions of all types. So not just banks, but community development financial institutions, community banks, credit unions, you know, anybody who, any lending institution that might do loans to businesses, there's just a low awareness of what employee ownership is. So chances are, if you walked into your bank or, you know, wherever you might bank, whatever type of institution that might be, if you walk into that institution, you're like, okay, great, I'm all ready, I'm going to do this. Can you finance the transaction? They're probably going to look at you a little cross-eyed and be like, okay, wait, hold on, how does this work? You and I have just talked through how does this work and how it's different. And banks are not familiar with that. In addition, depending on the form of employee ownership, there might be some challenges because most banks, most lending institutions require a personal guarantee on a loan. Okay, so let's go back to it's not the employee owners who are taking out the loan. It's the business that's taking out the loan. So you've got 100 employee owners, who's going to sign the personal guarantee? How do you choose who puts their own personal financials, you know, financial situation on the line for the business? Like, does that even make sense? So there's a real issue with the personal guarantee being a barrier, but do not fear. There are lending institutions that specialize in financing these transactions or specialize in providing working capital for employee-owned businesses. And by going directly to those institutions, you won't get somebody looking at you cross-eyed. Instead, you'll get somebody saying, fantastic, let's make this happen. Yeah. So Project Equity, we do have a loan fund, and we have also a really important partnership with a national CDFI that enables us to make loans both for the transaction as well as for that working capital. And we just launched, actually timed with Labor Day of 2021, what is called the Employee Ownership Catalyst Fund. And that fund really exists in order to provide very flexible capital for businesses that are either on the path to becoming employee owned. So maybe they're working on it. You as a business owner, you're working towards that 30% and you're like, oh, right, lawyers aren't free. So I got to pay some lawyers and I got to pay for this and I got to pay for that. And that should be really helpful to have a loan to cover that so that I don't have to do, you know, I'm also trying to reinvest in a whole bunch of stuff because of COVID and dealing with hiring challenges, right? So it'd be really helpful to have a working capital loan to cover that. So we can support you in that way in terms of your working capital needs while you're working towards the employee ownership transaction. And the transaction itself, we can play a role in financing that. So I mentioned earlier that $3 million that we were talking about wasn't, you know, it's probably not just a single bank. So probably the seller will have a portion of that $3 million. So, you know, on day one, when you do the transaction, maybe you'll get $2 million or a little bit more than that. And, you know, as a check on the day of the close. And then the rest of that, you'll be in a five-year timeline, just the same way the bank loan is on the five-year timeline. And so you get monthly payments or whatever the payment schedule is for the remainder, say it's $1 million. And it might even be that $2 million is a combination of an employee ownership fund, you know, a lending institution that specializes in and knows how to do this. And, you know, maybe it's a CDFI that doesn't do a lot of these, but is excited to learn by participating. So maybe we've got a couple of different lenders. And so that $3 million, just to make it easy, let's suppose it's made up of you, the seller, you're in for $1 million. Then I'll use the Employee Ownership Catalyst Fund as the next $1 million. And then a CDFI or a bank as the next $1 million. And so usually when you got multiple lenders, they all work out amongst themselves. It's what's called the waterfall or who's the most subordinated. And basically what it means is if the business goes belly up and can't pay back that $3 million, who gets the money first? So who's first in line? And so the most senior lender is most likely to be the bank. And then the next in line, a junior lender would be, you know, like in the case of our fund, well, we can take the junior position, the Employee Ownership Catalyst Fund. And then you at the seller note would be the most junior, the most subordinated in what's called that capital stack.
Just want to confirm, CDFI is Community Development Financial Institution, correct?
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
So is CDFI like a group of lenders or financial institution, or is just one? I never understand that portion.
Yeah, a CDFI, Community Development Financial Institution, is a federally regulated lending institution. So banks are federally regulated, community banks, credit unions, CDFIs, they're all federally regulated. The CDFIs, it's got the word community in it. So they are regulated in a way to support them to have positive community impact. Banks have positive community impact, right? I'm not saying that banks don't, but they have a little bit more flexibility in their regulation because of this community focus. That's why they exist. There's also some, you know, federal dollars that help them make lending dollars available. So there are, I don't know the numbers, but there are lots and lots and lots of, you know, CDFIs nationwide. And, you know, I would be surprised if each of your listeners didn't have one in their community. And some of them do small business lending. Not all of them do small business lending. And some of them are very familiar with employee ownership. The specialized employee ownership funds that exist out there, a lot of them are structured as CDFIs, not all of them. So yeah, the good news about trying to connect up to any of these financing resources is that any organization that is supporting you through that process of figuring out what your goals are and matching your goals to the form of employee ownership and helping you through that transition is going to know who all these folks are and can help you navigate that. You don't need to kind of be like, oh gosh, there's a whole nother thing of research I gotta get on. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. Just know and be confident that there is capital out there to be able to finance your transition. And if you work with an organization that is in this space, they'll be able to help you make those connections.
One of the things that a lot of businesses struggle when they get or they approach financial institution or any lending institution, the 5 C's criteria that a lot of lenders are doing. And you mentioned about personal guarantee. That is one of them. The other thing is about credit score, right? And a lot of, especially underrepresented founders are struggling to get loan because of the 5 C's, which is the personal guarantee and the credit score. How does it work when someone wants to transition to this employee ownership? Does credit score come into play?
It depends is the answer, because it depends on who's doing that loan. But if you're working with one of the CDFIs or loan funds that specializes in employee ownership, the approach is a little bit different from a kind of a traditional business loan. You know, for kind of what I talked about before, you got 100 owners, like who's going to do the personal guarantee? Whose credit score are you going to run, right? So really the analysis from the lending perspective is about how sound is the business, right? So looking back 5 years, and of course, understanding that COVID created some negative cash flows, profit and loss and balance sheet situations for businesses. But looking back 5 years, are the business fundamentals sound? Is the debt capacity analysis showing that the business is going to be able to comfortably pay this loan? Like we're not scraping every penny out of the business and the business has to double its profit in order to make those payments, right? So the future forecast that the debt capacity is based upon are reasonable and not too aggressive. So it's based upon the business fundamentals. It's also based upon understanding the leadership of the company, who those people are, their strengths, and understanding kind of the approach to employee ownership and the engagement there. So you just look at it through a slightly different lens, because it's not about sort of one person who's going to, you know, hold the bag, if you will, if things go south. It's about, this is more of a team effort, and we really need to be looking at the team.
Yeah, based on what you are just saying, though, it seems like the financial forecast, the financial foundation, the historical data from the financial results are really important in this process.
That's absolutely right. And it might be good for me to explain. So first off, if you're interested in just like learning more, because for most people, you haven't heard about it before, it's all brand new and there are a gazillion questions. Like, we are happy at Project Equity to talk with anybody. We've got a free consult, sign up on our website. Please come and chat with us. We'd love to learn more about your situation and your goals and talk about how employee ownership might be able to help you meet them. So there's, you know, a whole kind of exploration, a series of conversations. But then if you're like, okay, this is really interesting, I'd like to see what could be feasible. Is it feasible for me to do a 30% sale? Or gosh, I'd really like to retire in 3 years or 2 years. Is it feasible for me to do 100% sale in that time period? We engage in a feasibility analysis. And the first part of that is this debt capacity analysis. So we'll get 5 years of historicals from you. We'll work with you to develop a 5-year future forecast, and we'll actually do a high, medium, low scenario on that. That we won't be building the debt capacity around the high, right? So we'll do a combination of the medium and low to be conservative, and you know, clean out, like as you all know, as business owners, sometimes there's personal expenses that run through the business or that kind of thing. You know, we'll be forecasting forward to be able to understand what the ceiling of the sale price is. So the amount of debt that you can take on, back to that, your business is worth 10 million, but you're selling 30%. So you're selling $3 million worth. Well, if you can't afford the debt payments of 3 million, then maybe you're only selling 20% right now. or whatever it might be. So that's that ceiling of the sale price based upon the debt capacity. And then we dig more into the form of employee ownership and these questions that we were talking about earlier. You know, what is the for your goals? What's the right way to reach your goals? And we come up with a straw model, meaning a high level sketch of what it looks like. And then to the extent that it's important to have some employee involvement and different forms of employee ownership and different businesses choose to navigate this differently, then we can do some high-level employee engagement, either with a subset of employees or the broader group, again, depending on what the right fit for your situation is, at the tail end of the feasibility. So once you know, this is exciting, it's feasible, the roadmap looks good, let's then have a conversation where we bring that straw model to the employees, find out what the questions are, find out if there are hesitations or concerns so that we can figure out how to address those. That's about a 3 to 4 month process. And then from there, if it's thumbs up, then we'll work with you to get that transaction done. And that can be done in, you know, 6 to 12 months, again, depending on the business and the needs and the rhythm. And, you know, oftentimes you want to time that transaction with an end of quarter or end of year for make your accounting cleaner.
Allison, this has been really a lot of knowledge that you share, even for me and for my audience, obviously. Is there anything else that I haven't asked and then you would like to share it with my audience?
Yeah. So thanks for that question. And right now, I think probably everybody who's a business owner is listening to this in the current time period. There is just a real challenge with hiring, retaining, hiring back people, you know, as we are continuing to come out of the COVID-19 pandemic and engaging employees and keeping them engaged. And, you know, I would just really encourage folks to recognize that there is this powerful, powerful tool that is actual ownership, that ownership of a portion or all of the business combined with this ownership culture development. We all know that the business can only succeed if the employees are aligned and engaged. And this is a powerful tool that can help you engage your workforce, can actually help you grow your business faster, get to those goals faster, whatever they may be, if they're financial goals, if they're business success goals or mission related goals for your business. It's almost like now more than ever, we need this as a tool in our toolboxes to help our small businesses grow and be successful.
Allison, where can people connect with you?
Yeah, so we are at project-equity.org. And as I mentioned, we've got a free consult link right there on the top nav on every page. Please reach out. We would love to chat with you. And we'd love to learn more about your business and your goals and what you're trying to accomplish.
And any type of business, and then any size of revenue and number of employees, or only certain size?
Yeah, so employee ownership in the way that we're talking about it today really is a fit for companies that are about 10 employees or greater. You know, so if you're like, oh, this is great, I love it, and I'm maybe 5 employees today, that's fantastic. Keep doing what you're doing, be successful, grow your business, and you know, let's talk in the next year or so that we can help you get a plan in place for the right stage of maybe when your business gets a little bit bigger. And we do have a lot of different stories of employee-owned companies on our website. So we've got a tab on our site called Learn from Others. So if you're interested in just kind of perusing and seeing, chances are you'll probably find a company in an industry similar to yours. Kind of seeing how other businesses have done it can also be a really helpful way for business owners to get a better sense of how this all works.
Yes, your website is absolutely amazing. A lot of resources, a lot of case studies and stories. Allison, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
And that's bring us to the end of another show. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Her CEO Journey, the business finance podcast for women entrepreneurs. If you want to create a proactive financial plan and process for your business so you are ready to weather the financial storm over the next few months, let's chat and see what's possible for you. Book in a time to speak with me at christinashahli.com/let's chat.